Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
We're excited tonight to have Jeff Quinn here with his new book, Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. Jeff Quinn has been an award-winning investigative journalist as well as the author of 16 books. Two of his most recent books, The Last Gunfight, The Real Story of the Shootout of the OK Corral, and How It Changed the American West, and Go Down Together, The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde, both received outstanding reviews and became bestsellers. Jeff Quinn is a member of the Texas Literary Hall of Fame. And now, without further ado, will you join me in welcoming Jeff Quinn?
Well, thank you for coming out. Apparently, you're risking drowning in a monsoon on the way out. So normally people like it when I'm brief anyway. So tonight, please know I'm doing it for your safety as well. But before I talk about my book, I also want to say thank you for supporting an independent bookstore. Tattered Cover is famous around the country, I think deservedly so. And one of the reasons I'm thinking about that tonight, tonight's my 18th day on the road for the book. I have 10 more to go. I never pack enough socks, and it always catches up with me about this time. And in honor of the Tattered Cover, I wore my last clean pair of socks tonight. But I started out in New York, and one of the things I had to do in New York was give a talk at the only real remaining chain bookstore in America. We won't use the initials, you know, A, C, D, E, F, M, O, P, Q, R, S. And like any writer, I'm grateful for all bookstores. And as a reader, I'm grateful for all bookstores. But in this case, I got to the store early, and I did what all writers do. And this is sort of a trade secret that I'll share with you. Whenever we're going to give a program at a bookstore, we actually sneak in about 15 minutes before we're expected so we can look on the shelves and see how much of our backlist they're displaying. And if they've got a lot of our previous books, it's a good bookstore. And if they've only got the one that we're currently touring for, they're still a good bookstore because they're giving us a program, but maybe not quite the same. So in this bookstore, I decided I would see where they had put a novel I had written. And all my novels, as well as my nonfiction, really are based on real history versus mythology, trying to find the real story as opposed to sort of what's accepted out there. And I wrote a novel some years ago. It was my first national bestseller. And it was called The Autobiography of Santa Claus. And it was the history of Christmas with Santa sort of telling the story. The idea being I wanted to share the real history, but I sure didn't want to spoil the magic of the holiday. And something happened with that book that had never happened with any of my previous books. People bought it. That was a unique experience for me. And so I thought I'd see where this store has the autobiography of Santa Claus on their fiction shelves. Did they have it in the adult fiction or the children's fiction? And it turned out they didn't have it in either place. Couldn't find it. So I went upstairs to see, okay, I know they've got Manson because they've got, you know, the display downstairs. I'm going to see if they have The Last Gunfight and Go Down Together. And so I went up, and they did have those books in nonfiction. And to my amazement, in nonfiction, they also had the autobiography of Santa Claus. It was right next to It Takes a Village by Hillary Clinton. So I thought, well, we need to get this taken care of. And I asked to see the manager, who was not in. And the assistant manager wasn't in. But there was, you know, someone who appeared to me to be 12 years old. His name was Felix, and he was in charge while the important people were gone. And I asked him, can I talk to you for a minute? You've got a book of mine in the wrong place. Oh, really? Well, you know, we'll have to take care of that. What's the problem? And I said, well, the book is called The Autobiography of Santa Claus, and it's a novel, but you've got it right up there in autobiography. You know, it's next to Hillary Clinton's book. And he said, well, let me check. And you know how they get on the computer and sort of do these mysterious things, you know, and he did that. And he said, no, it's in the right place. It's nonfiction. I said, well, I've got to tell you that it isn't. You know, there's history in there, but there's also a lot of stuff I made up. And he said, well, I'll look again. No, corporate says it's nonfiction, so that's what it is. And I said, son, I wrote the book. You can trust me on this one. And he looked me in the eye and he said, if corporate says it's nonfiction, it's nonfiction. And that will never happen in the tattered cover. And that is why you have got to keep coming here and giving them your business. Okay, it's a great story. I told you that funny story to start because I always like to start with one. And there isn't really one that I can tell you involved in the book that I've just written, that's just been published, Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. What I thought I'd do tonight is I would give you a couple examples of things that happened during my research, some things I found out that were kind of surprising. And then I thought maybe you'd like to ask questions, because if you're here, I know I'm the only one in the room who's actually old enough to have been around in 1969. So all you young folks are going to have to use your imaginations, but you know, there may be some things you'd like to talk about, and that's why I'm here. I didn't set out necessarily to write a book about Charles Manson. All my nonfiction, in all of it, I try to choose an era in American history that I want to go back and recapture for readers, give a sense of what it was like to live in those times. Go down together with Bonnie and Clyde, I wanted to write a book about being poor in the Depression and the Dust Bowl. Last Gunfight, the story of the shootout at the OK Corral, which was really not a shootout but an arrest gone wrong and didn't happen at the OK Corral, but the accidental gunfire at the empty lot on Fremont Street in Tombstone just doesn't have that ring for a lot of historians. So I wanted to write then in that book about the final settling of the West and how that happened. So in wanting to write about the late 1960s, I tried to think, who's the iconic figure from that time, or what's an iconic event that will draw in readers, and then we can bring in all these other things? Because it's my belief that no event, nothing we remember from history or an individual we remember, nothing appears in a vacuum. There's all these different threads that are coming together in one place at one time. The experiences an individual has had, things that are going on in the country at that time. And while a lot of historians write books to tell you what happened, I try to write books that talk about how things happened and why they happened. And the seven murders over two nights, August 9th and 10th, 1969, in and of themselves are horrendous enough. But they didn't just happen. There had to be reasons, and I wanted to know what those were. When I decided I'd write a book about Charles Manson, before I actually committed to it, I tried to read all the other books that were out there. I'm assuming just about everybody in this room's read Helter Skelter, right? Vincent Bugliosi, who has become a good friend of mine and couldn't have been more helpful with this book, and Kurt Gentry wrote a brilliant, brilliant book. And this book was pretty much about the trial, first the arrest and then the trial of Manson and his other defendants. But I couldn't find any book that matched the one I wanted to write. If Charles Manson is a monster, and I can't assume that going in, how did we grow him? How did it happen? And I could not find a book that went all the way back. In terms of Manson's background, pretty much what everybody believes is the story he's told all these years. He was the illegitimate son of a teenage prostitute who cared so little for him, she once tried to sell him for a pitcher of beer. When he was 9 or 10 years old, she just didn't want to bother with him anymore and sort of threw him into the horrendous juvenile justice system of America in the 1940s. And because of that, he never had a chance. And his constant refrain over and over is that prison is my father and the street is my mother. And everything Charles Manson said in these statements about his background that he's made over and over are lies. And that's proven now, documented. The facts were always there. The story was always there. It's just that nobody actually got out on the road and went into the dusty old courthouses and went to the little towns in West Virginia where he had grown up and tried to find what actually happened. In the course of researching this book, I was able to find and interview for the first time ever Manson's sister Nancy and his cousin Joanne, and he lived with Joanne and his aunt and uncle for some time. If you look at the photo sections of the book, you will see pictures that nobody's ever seen before, and there's a reason for that. Joanne and Nancy pulled these right out of their photo albums. On the original photos, the black stickum is still on the back. You may remember back in the 40s and 50s, all the photo albums had those sort of black pages, you know, with the it was sort of like, what, map paper or something, and they'd stick the pictures on. If you tried to pull the picture off, there'd be black stuff stuck all on the back. I was able to track down people who went to elementary school with Manson, who were in his Sunday school church class with him, some old girlfriends. They had stories to tell, believe me. Some of his cellmates, people who knew him in the music scene in Los Angeles and in Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco. And finally, two of the few surviving members of the 9th and 10th convicted killers, Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel. And Krenwinkel, except for one quick soundbite on the 25th anniversary of the murders, has never talked about it at all. And she's never given a full statement about those nights, even to the police. And she did that for this book. So there's a lot of new information. What I thought I'd do is share with you four stories that I learned and was able to document in the course of researching this book. And then maybe I'll sum up a little bit and we can have some questions if you like. Here's the first one. Manson, when he is 5 years old, goes to live for 3.5 years in the little factory town of McMeekin in West Virginia along the Ohio River. It's about 6 miles south of Wheeling and 5 miles north of Moundsville, where the state prison is located, and that is where Manson's mother, Kathleen, has been sent. Not for prostitution. There is no record anywhere she was ever a prostitute. She was so inept at the one robbery she tried, it would seem impossible that she could be a prostitute for as many years as Manson claimed and not at least get arrested once. So she's in prison for 5 years, though she gets out in 3.5, for a really bungled robbery that is so goofy. It's still remembered in West Virginia today as the ketchup bottle burglary. And for those details, if you look in the book, you'll find out why they called it that. Manson went to live with his uncle and aunt, his cousin Joanne, who's 3 years older, and from the day he arrived, he was a problem for them. Joanne told me the story about Charlie in the first grade. It was later verified for me by a man named Richard Hawkey, whose mother was the principal at the time, and a couple other people who were in the class. In first grade, Charles Manson talked some girls into beating up a boy he didn't like. When the principal came looking for Charlie, he said, "You can't blame me for this. They were doing what they wanted to do. It's not my fault." The exact same alibi he offers in the Tate-LaBianca murders. The first person he violently attacked with a sharp instrument, a sickle he picked up in the backyard, was his cousin Joanne when he lost his temper. He did try to kill her. He was thankfully interrupted. But the things that he became famous for all those years later, he, in fact, was exhibiting when he was just a little tiny kid. And that was a story that made me feel maybe we're going to start seeing some things and some themes expand. Charles Manson is popularly known for his ability to just look into someone's eyes and in just in a few minutes, just in talking to them, the other person will feel that he's read their mind, he understands them, he's their friend, he's someone they want to know better. In Nashville, Tennessee, lives an 80-year-old man named Phil Kaufman. Any fans of 60s rock and roll in the room, you may remember the name Phil Kaufman because he was road manager for a number of famous acts, including the Rolling Stones and Graham Parsons. And at age 80, he's still a road manager for Dwight Yoakam and some other acts. He also was a cellmate of Charles Manson's in prison because Manson was in jail for, in the following order, car theft, armed robbery, pimping, and driving women over state lines for an immoral purpose, capped off by trying to forge a government check, and when he was caught, putting in his mouth, chewing it up, and trying to swallow it to dispose of the evidence. Kaufman was in jail because in those days where any form of narcotic was considered Satan's sort of instrument, he had accidentally been caught with 30 pounds of marijuana and wasn't able to hide it somewhere before the cops took him in. So they're cellmates. They're kind of friends because Kaufman thinks Manson's interesting. And we sat down in a cafe in Nashville. Phil Kaufman is the size of the entire Denver Broncos defensive line. And he's got a handlebar mustache out to here, and he came riding up to our lunch in the biggest Harley you have ever seen. We sit down to have lunch, and I said, Phil, here's what I want to ask you first. I've been in Los Angeles, I've been in San Francisco, and all I'm hearing from people is when I first talked to Charles Manson, it was just an amazing experience. He looked at me, he only talked to me for a minute or two, and I just felt like he understood me, and I wanted to talk to him more. So, Phil, did Charlie really have some kind of mystic ability? And Kaufman starts to laugh, and he's got a fist the size of a ham, and he slams it down on the table. He said, I've been waiting almost 50 years for somebody to ask me that question. And this is the story he told me. Right up to the year that Manson entered the prison system, the whole idea in federal prisons was to make it as bad as possible for inmates, to make it so horrible, to treat them so badly that they would never again want to commit a crime and go back to jail. But the recidivism rate just kept rising. So same year Manson goes in, there's a new philosophy in the federal prison system. And that is we're going to have classes, courses, and help inmates learn skills that will let them function better in the outside world when they get out. And I said to Kaufman, did Charlie take advantage of that? Oh, hell yes! And he signed up for a course in Dale Carnegie relationships. And Kaufman said from the first day Charlie was in the class, he came back to the cell practicing lines that he had heard in class. That he memorized those books. And jump ahead now, at the California Institution for Women prison where Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel are imprisoned, and I said to each of them in separate interviews, what could Manson possibly have said to you when you first met him that made you want to go with him, to listen to him more? And they said, well, Charlie said this, this, and this. Word for word, chapter 7, how to win friends and influence people. Charles Manson's big recruiting rap came straight out of the Dale Carnegie classes with not a word changed, folks. Do you have some of the Dale Carnegie hymn? Any of you who feel like it, you know, I hope you buy my book tonight, but if you're going to buy another one, subsidize Dale Carnegie, whose publicists are really unhappy with me for what I've written in this book. Check out chapter 7 for yourselves. And there is the basis of a lot of what Charles Manson did. He cribbed. He was never original. Third story. Charlie Manson, towards the end. The family is in the Mojave Desert. The Tate-LaBianca murders have occurred. Charlie's getting desperate. He hasn't gotten his recording contract. The murders haven't either caused a race war that he's been predicting to erupt. He hasn't even gotten his pal Bobby Beausoleil out of prison for the murder of Gary Hidman, which Charlie helped orchestrate, and he was very afraid Hidman was going to turn him over to the cops to try to get a better deal for himself. He's out in the desert. He has a presentiment, and again, both from Krenwinkel and Van Houten, he calls the family members together and says this: "If I'm ever arrested again, I'm going to put on my Crazy Charlie act, and I'm going to play Crazy Charlie as long as it takes until they decide I'm insane and let me go. But remember, it's an act. If you see me doing it, don't believe it. That's not me." Charles Manson is not now and never has been insane, not in the least. He is a smart, calculating man who always knows how to put on an act to make the effect that he wants, and that's what this has been. If there's anything in his life that sort of reflects to his credit, it's the fact he's been able to keep this up for 44 years now. While I was interviewing Leslie Van Houten, she showed me a letter Manson had sent her. He's still trying to keep some control over the people who followed him. And the letter said, "You wanted to change the world, but you let the world change you." He's still out there in his prison cell, and he's still trying to do things. Fourth story, he has a considerable number of followers today who are out in the real world. He has a website and an organization called ATWA, Air, Trees, Water, Animals, which is at least in theory devoted to the environment. And if you send him checks in prison, you might actually get a little of Charlie's prison art back. And he gave me written permission to reproduce some of it in the photo section of the book. He likes when he paints to incorporate the word helter skelter, some spiders, and the Nazi swastika. Those are sort of his trademarks. And there are Manson collectors all over this country who buy these paintings, and I met some of them. How do I know he still has current followers? I wrote Charlie every day for 5 months, asking to come interview him. He never responded, and then... Thanks for coming. He never responded, and then one day I get a letter from him. It's not a friendly letter. He doesn't want me to write this book. I think he's got a pretty good idea. If somebody really starts checking into his background, they're going to find that he's been lying a lot. But he ended up saying something cryptic. "They don't allow me to interview as I want." What I didn't know was that Manson had lost his visitation privileges 3 times in a row. The first 2 times for having unauthorized cell phones in his cell. The third time, though some of his current followers insist it was planted by the government, he had a shank in his cell. He had sharpened the handle of a toothbrush to a point because some other prisoner had irritated him, and he was planning to take care of it, 78 years old. I didn't hear from Charlie much after that, but he was kind enough to give my email address, my phone number, and my home address to some of his current followers, who have been diligent in staying in touch with me, all during my research, all during the time I've been writing the book. The surprising thing to me is they're all ages. They're from all kinds of backgrounds. Some of them are very well educated, and I've been writing to them back and forth, and we've had some good conversations, though now that the book's come out, they're denouncing me. They have a Facebook page, and according to them, on the Facebook page, everything in this book has been made up. And if that's true, why did I spend 3 years and drive 21,000 miles? It's not made up. If you check the notes section for each chapter, everything in it, all the information, I cite the specific source or person. Last thing about Charlie Manson before I'd like to take your questions. What I always am asked is, well, is it true that the first night of murders, he was trying to kill Terry Melcher, the record producer who hadn't signed him to a record deal, and he was trying to get even? You'll remember that I talked about how all different threads sort of come together. Some of the events don't happen in a vacuum. Part of the problem for Manson that led to the orchestration of the murders was his inability to get a recording contract. From the time he heard the Beatles while he was still in prison, he decided he would be a bigger rock and roll star than they were. He'd been writing his own songs. He brought his family of followers to Los Angeles for the express purpose of helping him get a record contract. He was sure that once he got signed, his records would be huge hits and he would become famous. Didn't happen. Terry Melcher did not sign him, the record producer, but it's also true that Dennis Wilson couldn't get him signed to Brother Records. Neil Young actually suggested to the people at his label that they listen to Manson, and there wasn't a deal out of that. John Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas heard his songs and passed. And a guy named Rudy Altobelli, who was the manager of a folk singer named Buffy St. Marie, if any of you remember her, also turned down Manson's songs. The problem for Manson is that he didn't get a record contract, and all his followers got to see that. He failed in front of them. And a leader can't be seen to fail like that, because that makes his followers lose faith. Charlie had to do something to get their minds off the fact that what he wanted most in his life and had tried to get, he did not have the ability, the talent to get. There was also a drug deal and a murder to cover up. Charlie and the family had been working as middlemen in drug deals, selling drugs to motorcycle gangs, raising money for their eventual move out into the Mojave Desert. Because of a drug deal gone bad, a friend of Manson and the family's named Bobby Beausoleil had recently murdered a music teacher and part-time drug dealer named Gary Hinman, and at Charlie's direction tried to make it look like black militants had committed the murder. Didn't work, though. Beausoleil was not the brightest bulb in the chandelier. He got caught by the police driving Hinman's car with a knife with Hinman's blood on it hidden in the tire well. Hinman was in prison for the murder. He was going to be tried. Manson was really worried that Beausoleil was going to roll over on him. He thought if there were copycat murders, the same thing, the same kind of black power symbols left, that maybe the police would say Beausoleil couldn't have done it, he's in prison, the same guy's out killing other people. So he was hoping that would work. And the final thing, he had been preaching to his followers for months, Helter Skelter was coming. Foretold by the Beatles in the Book of Revelation and also Charlie, the blacks were going to rise up against the whites and annihilate the whites while the war was going on. Manson and the family would be hiding in the Mojave Desert. When it was over, the blacks had won. They would not be able to govern themselves. The Manson family would come out of the desert and would be welcomed, and they would actually rule the world. And if that sounds pretty far-fetched, that gives you an idea of how much drugs he was pouring into these folks, and how he isolated them on Spahn Ranch and in the desert, kept talking and talking and talking, and pretty much wore them down. Though a few of them, including Krenwinkel, said they obeyed him not because they thought he was right anymore, but because they were so afraid of him. So that is how all these things came together. The reason they went to Melcher's house, old house, was not to kill Sharon Tate. It was because they felt that if they wanted to get the attention necessary to kick off the race war and get Bobby out of jail, they needed to make sure that blacks appeared to have killed rich, famous people, and only somebody rich and famous could afford to live in that place. They'd been there before trying to see Melcher. It was a place they knew how to get to. Second night, Lino and Rosemary LaBianca, again, were not picked because of who they were but where they lived. Manson and the family had been to parties at the house next door. They knew how to get to that house. That's why those people died. Other than that, my final conclusion, Manson's never getting out of jail. His next parole hearing won't be for another 14 years, and he's 78. But he's already surprised people by living this long with his three-pack-a-day habit. But of this, I am convinced. If Patricia Krenwinkel, if Leslie Van Houten were released today, they won't be. They won't be paroled. They have the Manson stigma. But they would not offer any threat, any danger to society. If you let Charlie Manson out, 78 years old, he would immediately put together some kind of following and he would direct them into some kind of crime. We're all better off with him where he is. What questions might you have just about this? And we can, we've got a lot of questions. Let's start with this.
Just about that. What is your next book?
I'll answer that question after we answer the Manson question. Who's got a Manson question? Yes, sir.
Is there a collection or library of the songs that Charlie Manson wrote?
There are a number of bootleg copies, bad ones, of the one album of Charlie Manson's recordings, and it was called Lie, and it came out in 1970. There were a number of tapes that had been made. People always thought the Lie album came from music recorded at Brian Wilson's house for the Beach Boys, but that's not true. A guy named Greg Erickson taped some of Charlie's songs in a little studio in L.A., and he had those tapes. When Charlie went to jail, he was arrested for the murders. He needed money for a defense fund. He asked his friend Phil Kaufman, who was living in L.A., swore he was innocent, asked Kaufman, would you get some records made, some vinyl pressed, and when I have an album, everybody's going to buy it, and then we'll have lots of money, it'll work. Kaufman, using his own money, pressed 3,000 copies of that album, and then discovered that not even the head shops in L.A. and in Berkeley would stock a Charlie Manson album, which meant there were 3,000 Lie albums sitting in Kaufman's garage. Manson refused to believe nobody would buy his wonderful music. He thought Kaufman probably sold them all and was keeping the money for himself. So he sent some of the family women, armed with knives, over to confront Kaufman and get the money. Unfortunately for these women, this time they weren't trying to break in on someone who was pregnant and a couple other show business types. Kaufman liked to sleep with a magnum under his pillow. He came out, let some blast loose just over their heads. They fled into the night, and as Kaufman said since, I have still got 2,926 of the damn albums, and he gave me one. And I would have brought it tonight, but, you know, trying to take it to 28 cities in all as many days. But if you want to hear some of Manson's music, not necessarily at its root, you know, you can go on Amazon, you can get some things like that. But the original tapes sound more like caterwauling than anything else. He told the women in the family that because they were women, they could be backup singers. Guess what? They couldn't. It really sounds like a cat is being ritualistically slaughtered in the background as Charlie sings.
What about sheet music?
You know, there's not only sheet music, but if you really care that much, you can get a Charlie Manson ringtone for your cell phone. Back in the back, yes, sir. Well, he was called Clem within the family. Clem was originally sentenced to death in the murder of Shorty Shea, one of the ranch hand who died afterwards. The judge overturned the jury by saying, this guy's so stupid, he never could have thought of murdering someone by himself. And he...
This was a female.
Oh, Susan Atkins died of cancer.
Yeah, that's a different one.
Okay, there's been quite a few... Yes. Oh, yeah, I sure do. I tried to talk to her. She didn't want to talk. She's living in upstate New York. She drives around in an old beat-up Volkswagen with a bumper sticker saying, Born Again Pagan. And she's got a 26-year-old boyfriend who is really big and mean. So when I asked her if she wanted to talk to me, and she said, no, I didn't think it was wise to insist. But that's where Squeaky is right now. Yeah. Not Lynette, but Squeaky. Yes, ma'am.
What is Manson's influence on pop culture today? Because we see the Guns N' Roses song and other...
Yeah, and there's another band named Kasabian and so forth. One of the parts of the Manson mythology that bothers me the most is you get so many young people now who've sort of heard of him and they think he's some kind of cool outlaw. When Guns N' Roses, for instance, recorded one of Manson's songs, I think a lot of it was a publicity ploy to say, boy, aren't we way out there that we would do this. The Lemonheads recorded a song. The last person, and you may be, I don't know if you know this musician, but I bet some of us older folks will. The last person to live in the Cielo Drive house before it was bulldozed down and a different house built in its place was a guy named Trent Reznor, who had a band called Nine Inch Nails. And Reznor at first didn't know what had happened in the house. When he found out, he was really excited. and he built a home recording studio in it. And he named the studio Le Pig in honor of the word that had been put scrawled in Sharon Tate's blood. And he and Nine Inch Nails recorded an album there. But he eventually moved, he said, because the people who would come by the house were just too strange. He'd come back to the house after being out for dinner. He said he'd always find flowers and roses sort of left in tribute by the front gate. And he couldn't tell whether they were being left in memory of Sharon Tate or in honor of Charles Manson. But there's been a lot of music focused around Manson. I suspect there will continue to be. Yes, sir. Right.
Because you're saying they're not just stupid youngsters.
Right.
Did you meet some of them? And what are they like as people?
Well, beyond the fact, after the first few emails and letters started to come to my house, and the mailman got very nervous coming because he's bringing me mail from Charles Manson, Leslie Van Houten, Patricia Krenwinkel, and then other people who are writing on the outside of the envelopes what they hope happens to me if I write a book that Charlie won't like. The first ones I ran into personally when I actually went up to Corcoran State Prison, because even if Charlie wasn't going to see me, I wanted to be able to describe in the book where he was being held, and there were some pup tents in the fields outside the prison. And quite often there are some people who camp out there in hopes the gates may open and Charlie will walk out to lead them. All his current followers seem to believe two specific things. The first is that Manson is unjustly being punished. They say he never killed anyone, which isn't true. He was physically involved with the murder of Shorty Shea. And that the government decided to ruin him because he was too brave and always told the truth. That's part one. Part two, they believe that only Charles Manson and his wisdom can save this country. They have no faith in the political system, which in some ways doesn't make them any different than a lot of political commentators on all over TV. But they truly believe that if Manson were allowed to come out in this modern day media age, that maybe he'd get a reality TV show. He'd certainly win. What was that thing Kelly Clarkson won that first year? American Idol. They all believe that he's such a great musician, he could go on American Idol and win that, and that this time people would listen to him. And, you know, they're very sincere in these beliefs. And I didn't expect when I finished the book that they were going to thank me. I mean, what are they going to say? Okay, you've proved it, you know, he fooled us. Or, Charlie is right, and I don't care what you say, you're lying. And that's their stance right now. But some of them, I will also say, seem to be decent people. I mean, I've had long talks with them, and they don't agree with me, but, you know, they don't threaten to kill me either. That can't be said for all of them. Yes, other questions? Okay, we'll do this lady and this lady and then this gentleman. Yes, ma'am.
What kind of diagnosis does he have? Is he under the care of doctors?
Manson has been tested over and over. He is not insane. He has never been insane. His IQ tests from the time he was first in federal prison right up to the time he's about 60 show him in the high normal range of intelligence. He is considered sociopathic, which means, of course, that he believes he's entitled to what he wants. He has no conscience in terms of how he treats others. But that's not a mental illness. It's just a terrible type of person to be. It would be more comforting to me if after these 3 years I believed he really was nuts. He isn't. And that's scarier than anything else, I think. Yes, ma'am.
You never hear anything about text spots. Were you able to?
There's a reason we never hear from Tex anymore. Tex has declared himself a born-again Christian and will only talk about the power of Christ to change our lives. Now, there's some debate whether his conversion is real or not. I always think we have to respect people's faith. You can't look into someone's heart and know in something like what they believe in terms of religion, whether they're telling the truth or not. I will say I was told this story by Stephen Kay, who was Bugliosi's assistant prosecutor when Watson was sent to prison for life, and who has stayed in touch with the prison officials where Watson has been serving time ever since. According to Kay, Watson founded Abounding Love Ministries, and set up a chapel service within the prison. And those inmates who qualified sort of for his brand of born-again Christianity were allowed to get off work detail and come to services every day. And again, this is according to Stephen Kay, not according to Charles Watson. They had to move Watson then because Abounding Love Ministries was his joke, because the acronym meant alms for tax. And Watson was actually organizing drug deals within the prison during these services. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but I do know that the prison authority said it was true and transferred Watson to another facility. So I did write Watson. I didn't get an answer from him. He's got some people outside the prison who follow him, who suggested that if I wanted to talk about the healing powers of Christ, I could probably talk to Charles, but not otherwise. And I didn't want to misrepresent what I would ask him about if I went to see him. I did find lots of people who grew up with him in Farmersville, Texas, and they told me stories. Tex in high school was such an all-American boy that the principal picked Tex out of the entire student body in Tex's senior year to be his personal assistant and make sure the other kids in school followed the rules. Just an interesting little side note. Sir, you asked me what's my next book. There's two answers to that one.
There's two books, then.
Well, I write fiction for Putnam and nonfiction for Simon & Schuster. For Putnam, they asked me if I'd like to write a series of non-traditional, traditional Western novels that kind of captured the spirit of my book, The Last Gunfight, and signed me up for a series, and the first book in that series will be coming out probably in May of next year. In January of this year, I will be starting my next nonfiction project. And hopefully in my books now, when you put them all together, there's a thread through American history. You know, we start with The Last Gunfight, The Settling of the Frontier, Billy the Kid, Jesse James. Then we go to go down together, Bonnie and Clyde. Jesse James and Billy the Kid were Clyde Barrow's role models. It sort of followed. Charles Manson is born the same year that Bonnie and Clyde die in that horrific ambush. So we move that forward. Now I want to write about America in the 1970s and some seminal figure who captured a lot of attention and how that happened. So my next book is really going to be about the life and times of Jim Jones. And what I'm hoping for with the tattered cover is in 2.5 or 3 years you'll invite me back and we'll all sit here in better weather and we'll talk about him. In the meantime, it always means a lot to all writers when people come out to listen to us and they want to hear us talk about their books. People like you are the reason we write, and I'm grateful to all of you for coming tonight. Thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.